The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, June 15th, 2007, and this is episode number 82. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here with you as always, bringing you this episode of MotoGP OD. Boy, my intro is starting to sound a little bit robotic, isn't it? Today is Friday, June 15th, 2007, but whatever. So, been a busy week. We had a fantastic race at Catalunya. Just one for the record books, another fantastic one. I've got a little race report going on about that. We talk about the qualifying. We talk about the race. We talk about the world championship standings as they are right now. We're going to do that. Then I have some comments about the commentary that we here in the United States experienced when CBS broadcast the Catalunya MotoGP, which I, your humble podcaster, completely dropped the ball of mentioning to you before the race. And I apologize for that. I knew that it was coming up and I forgot all about it. And I saw the stuff about CBS on, Friday after I'd posted the podcast or Saturday morning or something. I was like, oh no. So I actually got a few emails before the race of, I don't see it on there. And I have two emails. I managed to answer them. I know at least one guy, found the race because he'd been looking on Speed. It's not showing up. Only the 250 race was scheduled. So what's going on? And it was on CBS. And not to keep going on about that, but we're going to talk about that quite a bit. I have a little story going on that I think you'll enjoy where I compare the three different commentaries that I had access to: Eurosport, the official MotoGP, Dorna's commentary, and CBS. So we've got, Toby Moody, Julian Ryder versus Nick Harris and Matthew Roberts versus Jeff Metters and Kevin Schwantz. And I thought it was kind of neat, and hopefully you will like that segment. And then after that, we have a great chat with Liam Schubert, our man in Spain. So Liam's working, as you know, for the Pramac Dantin Ducati satellite team, and he took some time out of his busy day to talk to us a little bit about things that are going on over there and how Mugello and Catalunya went for the team and just general MotoGP stuff. It's always, always cool to talk to Liam, and we enjoy talking to him a lot and thank him very much for his time. Speaking of thank you, I got a ton of email this past week. In fact, more email than I could actually handle. My week was kind of busy. I had to, for work, I was not working in my office. I was going out in the field and doing stuff from 5 a.m. till 6 or 7 at night. I didn't have a whole lot of extra time, so I kind of fell behind a little bit on some of my emails. So if you sent an email and I didn't reply to you, I apologize. I started losing track, got a little bit swamped. I try to read them all. I generally do read them all. Some of these ones I sort of specifically save back for a few days because I sort of wanted to read and analyze and kind of think about when I had a little bit more time. So I've been doing that tonight as I record this podcast. In fact, I think we're going to share one of those emails right now with you. And this one here is from Javier Sanchez. And what was interesting was that we were talking about the 750cc theory, which you remember in the last episode, I threw out sort of as an aside a theory that perhaps one of the reasons that Suzuki was doing fairly well this season was that they have done so well for so long with the 750cc bike. I mean, in the AMA side of things, they effectively killed the old superstock class because it was just nothing but Suzuki's, and all the other manufacturers stopped making 750s because of Suzuki's absolute dominance in the class was partially, given the reason. And so we threw the theory out that, you got an 800cc MotoGP motorcycle. Maybe is Suzuki capitalizing on their knowledge of how to make a 750? I don't know. I mean, the bikes are going to be so significantly different that it was a theory. I'm kind of throwing it out there. I do have my doubts. But Javier says, so glad that you brought that up in the last podcast. During the preseason testing when Suzuki and Ducati were looking really good, I had given this some thought. I'm not sure if this is true outside of the U.S., but at least in this market, these are the only two major manufacturers who year after year have R&D'd and mass-produced a 750cc sport bike. Up until the first race, I thought the Suzuki would have the RC211V of the 800 standard era, since the 750 Ducati competes with 600cc inline fours, while the GSXR 750 can beat the leader bikes on certain tracks. Well, Ducati certainly proved me wrong, but I still think that both of these manufacturers had far more development and data to take to these new 800cc bikes than anyone else. My understanding is that in the last couple of years, I forget which rag I read this in, the GSXR 750 is a 600 frame with their 750 engine. Javier, that's been in, yeah, most of the sport rider, motorcyclists I know have mentioned that. And I have heard the same thing. Javier continues. Sorry about that. If you look at the specs on their size, or excuse me, on the Suzuki site, side by side, they are indeed identical between the two, except for the displacement and bore stroke. With only 2 kilograms of weight difference, even the 310mm brakes are the same on the two machines. I have to believe that this head start has given these two companies a significant advantage in MotoGP 800cc chassis development. Unfortunately for Suzuki, I think that this was their 1 year to make it happen. Once Yamaha and Honda catch up, it's back to the back of the grid. But seeing Hoppy on the podium, I was so happy for him that I was choked up. And thank you, Javier. That's an excellent email. I appreciate it a lot. And I thought that's insightful stuff. And I think you've got a lot of points there. You're probably about right. And I think that you can't help but help. You know, these factories, although, you know, these are large companies with many different departments. And particularly in the case of Ducati, you've almost got two separate companies of, you know, race and manufacturing, but they share knowledge. They, you know, it is a big knowledge pool. So if the company is efficient enough to be able to sort of share that knowledge effectively, then, you know, it certainly can't hurt. And something is helping Suzuki and Ducati. Although, as we saw in Catalonia, that gap is closing and closing rapidly. Honda is starting to catch up, and the giant Honda machine will eventually catch up and dominate. And Yamaha is not doing too bad either. So whatever, it's this 800cc thing. I really had my doubts, and I thought it was a bunch of crap, to be honest with you. But so far, I pretty much am enjoying these races. Got quite a few other emails. One of them I'm going to read during our call with Liam, and kind of ask Liam what he thinks about 16-inch tires and stuff like that. Some of the others just didn't have time, like I said, to get to, but we're working on everything and taking the suggestions, and I always like to get the email, and like I said, if I did not personally send you a reply and everything, I do apologize, but believe me, your email did not go unread. I do read them all, and I'm kind of trying to play a little bit of catch-up here over the next couple of days to finish off saying, you know, at least if nothing else, hey, thank you very much for listening. And that kind of brings things up. Several of the emails that I received over the last couple of weeks mentioned that you guys are new listeners out there, which I'm a little shocked, to be honest with you. Not the numbers that I get, that I see, of how many people have subscribed to the feed in iTunes and you know, downloads and this and that and the other, seem to be fairly stable. And downloads is going up a little bit, but so much of the downloads is like robots and stuff like that, that, you know, I almost can't trust those numbers. It takes longer to kind of filter out the junk than you know, it's worth. I just, you know, and it's not like this is a business. This is just, like I said before, this is my hobby. You know, I'm just basically a guy with a microphone and a fairly sizable internet bill. But it's good to see new listeners. I'm really glad you guys are finding the podcast. I appreciate it a lot. And basically, I'm getting the point I'm trying to get to here in a rambly, roundabout way is tell your friends. If you go to internet forums, or if you go on motorcycle rides, or if you watch MotoGP with a friend or whatever, and if you like MotoGPOD, go ahead and tell your friends. Maybe they'll like it too. And, you know, the more listeners, the merrier. If nothing else, it's a kind of an ego boost for me, which, you know, that's part of the whole thing, right? And I think that's about it. Oh, one other thing I did want to mention. We've got Laguna Seca coming up the weekend of July 20th through the 22nd. Don't forget, that's Laguna Seca, the U.S. Grand Prix, the Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix at Laguna Seca. I, of course, am going. Jules Cizik's going. I'm going down with some friends, one of my buddies from the Navy, and then an old high school friend and stuff like that. And I'm going for myself. I'm going to tell you that right up front. I'm not going as a podcaster. I don't have any kind of press credentials. Dorna, you know, would never issue those to some amateur guy with a microphone and a big internet bill like myself. And So, you know, I'm not going to be concentrating on MotoGPOD, but I will be recording some background stuff and, you know, who knows what'll come up. I'm going to take a little recorder and we'll get some stuff. If nothing else, I want the sounds of the new 800cc bikes. And I've also had several listeners suggest, you know, kind of a meet, get together sort of a thing. And while I don't want to go to any great lengths of formal, you know, like the official MotoGPOD party or anything like that, I just, no, that's not going to happen. But I would like to meet you guys. So if, basically, I'll tell you what, I'll be announcing where my seat is, and because I've got grandstand seats all over the place, and not that I'm going to be parking my butt there all day long. I will be, you know, sort of using it as a little base, and I'll be wandering around, and I'll probably be wearing a MotoGPOD t-shirt. And, you know, maybe we can get something going of saying, like, you know, okay, on Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock, we meet, you know, somewhere, that kind of thing, something along those lines. I wouldn't mind, because I'd like to meet you guys. And so if you have feedback on that, if you have an idea of what would be a good time to meet, or if you care or anything like that, feel free to email me. Bob@motogpod.com is the address, or we could even start a thread on, say, the Ride On 2 forums or something like that. If you haven't been to rideon2.com, it's an excellent motorcycle racing blog and forum, sort of a site. It's rideon2, T-W-O, rideon2.com, and the forums there are great, and they are a lot of participation there. You can throw out some questions and or just arguments or whatever you want to do. Start a little discussion going on. There's all kinds of fun stuff. Access to great pictures that Jim Race puts up, and all sorts of stuff. Jim Race and Jules Cisick have are the founders, along with others on that board, and whatever. It's a good board. And there's also, of course, many, many other places and stuff, many, some of which I go to, some of which I don't. So I'm kind of rambling on here a little bit, but let's put it down to the fact that, yes, I would like to say hello to as many people as I can at the Gunaseca, and we just sort of need to work out a few small details. But enough of that. Why don't we stop blathering on and get on the show? We're going to start with our Catalunya race wrap-up. Let's talk a little bit about Catalunya. It was just a fantastic weekend for MotoGP. Really, really good stuff. Watched the race on both MotoGP.com live, and then I watched it again on the CBS commentary. And it was, I enjoyed the race thoroughly both times, even despite the crappy CBS commentary. So I'm going to cover qualifying real quick. I'm going to do something that I've been trying to avoid doing for quite some time and basically just read the press release, but I didn't have a lot of time to prep a story. And then we'll talk about the race. So qualifying. Saturday's MotoGP qualifying session for the Gran Premio Cinzano di Catalunya saw Valentino Rossi take his fourth pole position of the season as he looks to reduce Casey Stoner's world championship lead. The doctor set a new circuit best lap of 1 minute 41.84 seconds on the 23rd of his 27 laps to put him in a good position to win his fourth Catalunian Grand Prix in a row. However, the Fiat Yamaha rider will need to break the current MotoGP pole jinx to take victory, as none of the last eight Grand Prix have been won by the rider starting at the front of the grid. Rossi will face a stiff challenge tomorrow from Hone rider Dani Pedrosa, with the Catalan Repsol Honda man in good form and third on the grid, just 1.162 seconds behind Rossi, whilst Ducati Marlboro's championship leader Stoner starts from fourth with a time that is 0.277 seconds behind the Italian. A heroic qualifying display by Randy Depugne saw the injured Kawasaki rider take second place on the grid with a best effort early in the session, just 61/1000 of a second off of Rossi's best, which is despite the Frenchman's badly swollen knee, which is causing him significant pain following his Mugello crash. And incidentally, he had to have specially made leathers to get those on over his over that knee. Depugne's success helped to lift the mood in the Kawasaki pit box after colleague Olivier Jacques' crash earlier in the day prevented him from qualifying. Olivier is okay. He had a neck injury, but you know, he should be okay. He has said that he's going to be fit to race at Donington next week, but there hasn't been any official announcement yet one way or the other on that. I was looking around on the news and I couldn't find anything. Now, if he does miss Donington, we might see Fonzi Nieto come and ride for him again, like happened at Le Mans, or we might possibly see 250cc rider Anthony West could get the ride because he did some testing for Kawasaki at Catalunya on the Monday after the race. That's kind of interesting stuff. Now back to our little press release. Another solid run from Rizla Suzuki's John Hopkins saw him take fifth, just ahead of fellow Americans Colin Edwards and an improved Nicky Hayden, who seemed to be fairly pleased with his seventh place starting slot. And the Honda Gresini pair of Tony Elias, who, like Pedrosa, grew up not far from the Catalunya track, and Marco Melandri completed the top 10 with Pramac Dantin's Alex Hoffman. We've got five different constructors represented in the top five, less than a second separating the top nine, and a real mixture of Bridgestone and Michelin-equipped riders in the top 10. The race promises to be an open and unpredictable affair. So like I said, sorry for just reading the press release. It's kind of cheating, but I just did not have time. Let me run down the grid real quick, at least the top few. First position was Rossi, second Depunier, third Pedrosa, fourth Stoner, fifth Hopkins, sixth Edwards, seventh Hayden, eighth Tony Elias, ninth Marco Melandri, tenth Alex Hoffman, yay Pramac, 11th Chris Vermeulen, 12th Shinya Nakano, former engineering student, 13th Sylvain Guintoli, 14th Alex Barros, 15th Carlos Checa, 16th Makoto Tomata, 17th Loris Caparossi, his worst grid position ever. Not sure what happened there, to be honest with you. I haven't done enough reading of the news, but that sucks. 18th Kenny Roberts Jr. and 19th Curtis Roberts. Team Roberts back there. Let's see there. Ooh, significantly off the pace. Actually, Kenny Roberts is, well, he's 3/10 behind Loris Caparossi and 2.4 seconds behind Valentino Rossi. So not, you know, but Curtis Roberts is 3.3 seconds off, almost 3.9 seconds off of Valentino Rossi's time, about a second off of Kenny's time, which is, you know, understandable. I mean, he's new to the bike and whatever. And then Olivier Jacques did not qualify because of that injury that we talked about earlier. Now let's talk about the race a little bit here. I'm just going to wing this one. I took some notes as I watched the race, like I always try to do. And I'm basically going to make it up as I go along. So we're going to see how things go. I've got paper spread out all over the desk. I might be looking around. So sometimes you might hear me talking like this when I'm not facing the microphone. I apologize for that in advance. But like I said, it's a fantastic race. Pedrosa got the whole shot. He just, bam, took off like a rocket. Rossi did not get a very good start. We've seen that before. Rossi is not always the best starter for whatever reason. Stoner also got a fantastic start. So we just led right in there with Pedrosa and followed closely by Stoner. Now, the coverage cut away to an onboard from Caparossi, you know, way the hell in the back of the race, right after the start. And I was a little bit like, wait, you know, what the hell are you doing? I want to see what's going on up front. So I was a little disappointed in that. And I'm not sure where that one came from with our Spanish directors of the race that day. On lap two, we had Hopkins in third. Rossi was down in fourth. Rossi did manage to pass Hopper, but he couldn't make it stick. But Stoner did pass Pedrosa, and Stoner continued to lead and led every lap from then on. Officially, you know, when they crossing the start-finish line, he led every lap all the way down through lap 17. It's an amazing race from Stoner. On the third lap, Stoner was leading, like I said, at the start of the lap. Rossi gets by Hopkins. He's now in third. And Pedrosa had a fast lap, very fast lap. He was 3/10, almost 4/10 faster than Rossi and making an excellent pace. And in the middle of that three, Pedrosa tries to pass Stoner but just can't kind of do it. Lap four, Elias and Depunier touch. That was a classic of Elias's different line affecting other riders, and he basically sort of came back across the thing and kind of nailed Depunier. He cut right in front of him. There was lucky there was no crash on that. Lap five, there was a little bit of, actually the gesturing was between other riders, so I'm not sure what happened on between the two of them on that one. Lap five, Stoner and Pedrosa were opening a gap. Pedrosa was right on Stoner, but Rossi manages to close it up along with Hopper. So you've got all four riders doing real well. Rossi and Hopkins were both 3 or 4/10 faster than Stoner or Pedrosa on lap five. They managed to close that up quite a bit. And so we started looking like we were having a gap, and those guys close it up. And you've got the top four guys just right there. And then by lap 7 or 8 or so, the first four of that group were breaking away. You got Stoner, Pedrosa, Rossi, and Hopkins all doing their own thing, all just right on one another. Lap 10, Rossi manages to pass Pedrosa to get into second position. and on a typical classic Rossi pass, late on the brakes, doing it on the turn after he sort of stalks him for a lap or two, making sure that Pedrosa's not going to, you know, what is he doing in this corner and all that, and then Rossi makes the pass. It's just classic Rossi. On lap 11, Rossi shows Stoner a wheel. He just, you know, sort of letting him know that he's there. And lap 14, Tony Elias done blowed up. Skipped a few notes there of some laps. Sorry, folks, I was watching the race. But on lap 14, Tony Elias' engine started spewing smoke and oil and stuff all over the track, and he trundled off, and that was the end of his race. That was the only DNF that we had. So other than Jacques' misfortune in the qualifying session of injuring and not even being able to race at all, and then Elias having a blown-up Honda, we had everybody else finish. That's good to see. Depunier was pretty much riding all by himself and fifth position at this point on lap 15th, riding a nice race. And those top five spots, 1 through 5, you've got five different manufacturers, you know, Honda, Yamaha, Ducati, Suzuki, and Kawasaki. It's just, that's great to see. That is so good for the sport. It's cool to see. It's just fantastic stuff. Lap 16, Pedrosa has closed way up in third. He started sort of looking like he was going to do his drop back thing where the second part of the race, he can't kind of keep the lap paces up, but he managed to close that up. And so we've got the top three are breaking away a little bit now from Stoner in fourth. Actually, I wrote Stoner in fourth, but no, I'm sorry about that. It was Hopkins in fourth. That was my mistake. But whatever. On lap 17, Rossi passes Stoner, and he barely makes it stick. Now, it was just a fantastic one, and then Stoner is just all over the rear end of Rossi. Stoner manages to get past him on the front straight, and Rossi passes back. I mean, it's just lead change after lead change. I wrote in my notes, holy crap, what a lap. There's just side by side going through the corners, swapping positions. Stoner was riding a fantastic race. It was beautiful. So was Rossi, but you got to admire Stoner, you know, for a young guy, first year on the Ducati, it was unbelievable. And I also made a note to myself here, do you think that this is like China, where Rossi is at the limit, but Stoner is not so much, where Stoner has a little bit more to offer? And I think it's true, and I'm going to talk a little bit later on in this show when we talk to Liam, I kind of throw that one out to Liam and we'll see what he thinks. But I think that that's what's going on. That Rossi is riding this Yamaha beyond what it's really capable of in the hands of ordinary mere mortals. And whereas Stoner is doing a fantastic, super fantastic job, no doubt, on the Ducati, and is a very talented young man, but he's got a little bit more to offer, and that's just going to work to Stoner's advantage. Okay, lap 19. On the beginning of lap 19, Stoner is back in front just barely. At the end of the lap, Rossi passes, but then Stoner passes him back. And if you look, when you watch the race on MotoGP.com, if you have the live feed and all that, and you get the live timing, one of the things that they have on the various screens of this stuff is a little bar chart with different colored lines for each rider of who is in first at the end of lap 17, at the end of lap 18, and so on and so forth. So this thing tends to be, you know, somebody will start off in third place on the grid, and they move up to second, and they move up to first, and their little line follows a fairly sort of even progression. But for the last, I don't know, almost the last six or seven laps of this race, Rossi and Stoner just swap back and forth, and it makes this little X pattern across the top of the bar chart, and it just is showing you, and this is only at one point on the lap. You know, the whole rest of the lap when these guys are swapping for the lead isn't documented, but it was happening, and it was just crazy stuff. It was so good. Such a great race. Lap 21, Rossi passes Stoner for first. Crowd's going wild. Everybody's freaking out. Yay, it was fantastic. It was just, you know, like I said, good racing. Lap 22nd, Rossi manages to hold off Stoner at turn one by later braking. He's just a demon on the brakes, like I said. Even though that Ducati was powering up on that front straight and Stoner was using everything he could to get past Rossi, Rossi's using his, like I said, demonic late braking ability to hold him off. So at the end of that lap, Rossi was still in the lead. Then on lap 23, Stoner takes the lead and he makes it stick. And for the final lap, lap 25, Stoner manages to hold Rossi off on that whole last lap. It was just amazing stuff in the final sector. Going into the turn, you really had no idea who was going to win. Because the first, second, and third were so close up there, though. Rossi couldn't do any of his kind of just Hail Mary, go for broke, I got to get the lead kind of moves because, you know, had he screwed that up, he might have lost second position. And, you know, this isn't an original thought from me. I heard it on the commentary. Jules mentioned it, and, you know, it's a fact. But so that might have affected somewhat Rossi's race strategy for that last lap. He might have sort of been thinking, well, second is going to have to do. But there was no doubt that he was looking for the slightest mistake from Stoner, ready to capitalize on it. It wasn't like he was just letting Stoner take off. He just wasn't quite doing the crazy stuff that he might do in another race when if the first and second guys had more of a gap back to third. But overall, what a race. Fantastic stuff. In Nick Harris's words, the best race of the season. And I agree. I mean, like I said, I've said this so many times this season, I hope that I continue saying it throughout the rest of the season, that every race is just fantastic one way or the other. You know, you've got a few little lulls here and there, but not in this race. This Barcelona race, when I got up early on Sunday morning to watch it live on MotoGP.com, I was so tired. I'd gotten to bed at like after 2 o'clock, and then I get up at 4:30 to watch the race, and I was thinking, you know, I'm going to doze off watching this race, and there was no way that wasn't happening. I could barely go back to bed after the race to get more sleep. It was just fantastic stuff. So, running down the race classification, we had Casey Stoner as the winner. Then Valentino Rossi was only 69/1000ths behind him in second position. Like I said, very, very close finish. Danny Pedrosa third on the podium. He was about 0.4 behind Stoner. So, like I said, very close. Still right up there. The top three guys, you could cover him with a blanket, as everybody's saying. Fourth position went to John Hopkins. Another satisfactory performance for him. He's hungering for a podium. We're going to see him on the podium again soon, hopefully real soon. But fourth is not too shabby. You know, we can't complain too much about that. Fifth position, Randy Dupuis, which he should be ecstatic about that. I mean, the Kawasaki is up there in fifth. And again, the five finishing motorcycles here are from five different manufacturers. This is great stuff. But he was way back. He was 17.8 seconds behind Stoner, so he was riding his own race there in fifth. Then Loris Caparossi doing very well, coming up from 17th on the grid to finish sixth. And he had quite a battle there with Vermeulen and barely managed to pull off that sixth. Vermeulen was in seventh. Alex Barros took eighth place, also having his own battle going on with Marco Melandri. Those two guys finished 1/10 of a second apart in eighth and ninth place, Barros and Melandri. 10th spot went to Colin Edwards. 11th spot, Nicky Hayden. Another somewhat disappointing race for Hayden. And 12th spot, Makoto Tomata on the Dunlop Yamaha Tech 3. Kind of a surprise there. 13th went to Alex Hoffman, getting him 3 championship points. Put that down in quite a ways down there. Sylvain Guintoli on the other Dunlop Yamaha Tech 3 was in 14th spot. Shinya Nakano took 15th on the Konica Minolta Honda. Then Kenny Roberts Jr., 16th spot for Team Roberts. And Carlos Checa, 17th. Now, I didn't do any research on what the hell happened to Carlos, but he was way, way down there, wasn't he? And especially after, let's see, where did he qualify? He qualified in 15th, so it's not like he qualified all that great, but he still lost 2 positions. And it's kind of significant that Team KR, you know, it's a good thing Kenny Roberts finished ahead of somebody. So, you know, that's promising, and hopefully that continues. But he must have had some sort of problem or another, because he's like 3 seconds behind Kenny Roberts Jr. Then 18th spot went to Curtis Roberts, finished the race. That's great. They're making progress. What can you say? Slow, you know, baby steps. Not classified, Tony Elias, like I said, engine done blowed up on lap 14 and did not start at all, was Olivier Jacques. So now for the standings, what does that do to our standings? In the World Championship standings for 2007, after the 7th round of 18 at Catalunya, we have Casey Stoner in first position with 140 points. Valentino Rossi, second position with 126 points. So 14 points separate the two. Stoner managed to open up his lead a little bit by 5 points because first and second. So, you know, he's not doing too bad. 14 points ahead at this point in the series is decent. It's not spectacular. It's not tiny. I looked back over the last few seasons. In 2006, at this point, after seven races, Hayden had 119 to Caparossi's 99. So Hayden was 20 points ahead in 2006 when Hayden was having a good season. In 2005, Rossi had 170 points. He had won six out of seven. He's only took second place in Portugal. All the other were first, he had won every race up to that point, six out of seven. Melandri was way, way far back at 107, so a 63-point gap after seven races. Back in 2004, Rossi and Gibernau were both on 126. Now, Rossi had the lead because he had four wins compared to Gibernau's, well, don't have that note in front of me, but I think it was one. No, it was two. But in any case, Rossi, in 2004, Rossi and Gibernau were tied, or, well, numerically tied at 126 after seven races. So that was a very close season up to that point. 2003, we had Rossi at 151 and Gibbers at 113. So that is a difference of 38 points. So, like I said, you can see that, Stoner's 14-point lead can't really be called comfortable. He's, you know, he's got somewhat of a lead, but typically by this point in the season, after seven races, most of the time it's been a larger lead. What's going to happen the rest of the season remains to be seen, and we will just have to continue watching it and, of course, continue listening to MotoGPOD to find out. But I think it's going to be a really super interesting season. I've got a kind of a commentary about the commentary that I'm going to talk about here with the CBS's production of the Catalunya GP that we had here in the United States, which is the first time that CBS has shown MotoGP racing, and a fairly new thing for MotoGP to be on over-the-air television. We had it on Fox for the Laguna Seca GP and that sort of thing. But MotoGP has, you know, primarily been a thing that's on speed on cable channels or satellite, and not everybody has access to this. It's generally on the second or third sort of tier of pricing. So not everybody gets Speed Channel. Not everybody gets to experience MotoGP. So when I first saw that CBS was running it, it was like, wow, that's kind of cool and everything. And even though, like I said earlier on, I dropped the ball about telling you guys about it for this race, I'm not sure what happened there. It was still, you know, I was fairly excited. I knew the commentary wasn't going to be up to snuff. But I still, I want to talk about it a little bit. So basically, let's launch into this. And CBS's commentary on that race, it was done by a guy named Jeff Metters, who was doing the play-by-play, and then Kevin Schwantz, who we all know, you know, 500cc world champion and motorcycle personality. You know, everybody knows Kevin Schwantz. Now, I'd never heard of Metters before, so, you know, I really don't watch a lot of sports, of stick and ball sports. You know, I don't watch much sports at all besides motorcycle racing and some car racing. So I hadn't heard of him, so I Googled him. It turns out that he seems to do a lot of animal sports, announcing stuff like bull riding and horse racing and fishing, things like this, which can even be called a spectator sport. And I thought that was a little bit of an odd choice to be a MotoGP announcer, but, you know, I'm not the CBS sports president guy or whatever, so they had this Jeff Metters guy doing it. One press release described Metters as legendary sports analyst Jeff Metters. So, yeah, whatever. But I did have a few problems with the whole production. Metters started off sounding like a golf announcer. His intro thingy that they did in their little pre-race show was just a real snooze fest. And when he said that MotoGP is, quote, the NASCAR of motorcycle racing, kind of a little part of me inside just died. And could he possibly make MotoGP sound more foreign? He made sure to tell us at least six times that it was a European thing. He might as well just said them damn foreigners on them crazy motorcycles. I mean, it was a little bit like that. I was a little alarmed at that. Then later during the pre-race stuff, again, CBS put on a decent sort of a pre-race show that at least they put together, and they made an effort. But later during that pre-race show, Metters said that Catalunya is very dangerous, and whatever. It's just like those super ovals and bull rings, for that matter, are just all safe as houses. You know, sports tend to be dangerous, and to overplay the, oh, it's so dangerous and everything, I think is a big mistake. Now, Kevin Schwantz, which, you know, yay, go Kevin. We all love Kevin Schwantz. He was doing the color guy sort of thing to Metters' play-by-play, and I've really got no problem with him as a choice. He might not be the most bouncy bouncy former racer that we could find, but he's still very involved in the sport. He knows
what to do about being a color guy. He's, you know, he would be a good choice if you gave him the right sort of play-by-play guy, maybe even have a third guy to work with so that, you know, he's playing off of Kevin's sort of straight man act that he's got going on. And I think Kevin would actually be perfect. But it was a little funny to see because when they actually showed on camera Metters and Schwantz, we can see that Kevin is just wearing this plaid, short sleeve, regular old button up shirt. You know, it doesn't even look like it's tucked in. It's just a guy at the races. Whereas Metters was wearing, you know, a CBS polo shirt with a logo and all that business. So I don't know. Did Schwantz not want to wear the CBS shirt? It was just, that was a little weird. You know, maybe that's normal for all I know, but it just struck me as kind of odd. We never actually see the announcers for MotoGP commentary here in the States. We typically just hear Nick Harris and Matthew Roberts and all that team. But, you know, it is, like I said, it's kind of cool that they had these guys on camera. It sure as hell looked like they were actually in Spain, and they were. It could have been possibly done with blue screen, but it wasn't. They were in Spain. And now all this pre-race stuff that they did, which, you know, wasn't that long, but all this pre-race stuff that they did cut into our race coverage a little bit, which is kind of alarming when you only have an hour. But it worked out pretty well. Now, one of the other things that I thought was weird when they showed the two announcers was that Schwantz was standing completely behind Metters. They weren't side by side. They weren't sort of looking at each other. They're in kind of a tight area that they had him there. And that must have been why they did it. But it was basically like Schwantz is behind Metters, which I thought was a little strange. So then onto the race, once they actually started the race, after watching the first few laps, it just seems like Metters did do some research, and he came to the race, you know, mostly prepared. He threw out some interesting little trivia tidbits, like mentioning that Shinya Nakano used to be an engineering student, things like that, which actually I didn't even know that one. And he talked about the champion standings, like, you know, he'd at least read up on it and all that. So, I mean, the guy is clearly, he's a professional, and so we should expect that he's not going to show up completely unprepared and tank it. But he had a few missteps. He misspoke once or twice, and that's totally understandable. But again, he really did seem to emphasize, he wanted to emphasize that this isn't an American series. At one point he said, they race clockwise over here in Europe. And it's like, hey, Jeff, newsflash, they race clockwise on most road courses, even here in the good old US of A. So maybe you should say that not all racing is done on an oval rather than, you know, they race clockwise here in Europe. But still, through at least the first half of the race, neither guy seemed very excited. Actually, through the entire race, neither guy seemed very excited. It was a very dry, unemotional commentary. And that's not going to win a whole lot of viewers, in my personal opinion. Now, those of us that are in the know about MotoGP are going to be aware that MotoGP is as exciting as it could be just on its own. You know, no commentary necessary. But we do have to remember that this race is on CBS, and it's going to be shown to a lot of people that aren't big super fans of MotoGP, and they might need the commentary or something to spice things up to bring them back to watch it again. So, that said, that's kind of my quick rundown of what I thought of the commentary. Now, we've got a little interesting thing here coming up. First of all, I do want to talk about the commercial breaks that CBS ran. I actually sort of clocked them. Let's see. After the flag drop, that's when I started counting commercials. After the flag, they went to a commercial on lap 4. They had 3 commercials for 1.5 minutes. They came back on lap 5. So we didn't miss too much. It wasn't quite the Speed Channel edit where they, you know, 7 laps are gone. After lap 8, they went to 5 commercials for 2.5 minutes, but they came back on the same lap a little bit later, but at least, you know, it was the same lap, and we only missed part of lap 8. Lap 11 just at the end, so now we've got, you know, every 3 laps you get a commercial break. They had 3 commercials for another minute and a half, but they came back in through lap 14. So that time they missed 2.5 laps. It's kind of a lot. And then, let's see, on lap 19, they ran 2 commercials, which is kind of like, you know, why bother going to break for only 2 commercials? And then they came back with a little bit of MotoGP graphics and music and all that business, which was kind of cool. But we didn't end up missing much, if any, of the lap. So the commercial breaks weren't too bad. They actually did a pretty good job, I thought, on that. And like I said, other than the commentary was just a little dry. They need to work on that. Their next race that CBS is going to be doing is Assen. And they're actually broadcasting it on Saturday, which is cool. Good job to CBS for that, not waiting till Sunday. It is tape delayed, so it's a little bit later in the day. It's not going to be live. But at least it is on Saturday. And then they're going to do the Socks and Ring race as well, which is after Assen. So Donington, which is our next race, is going to be on Speed TV. So don't look at CBS until Assen comes up. So Donington on the 24th, go to Speed TV. Now that I've told you a little bit about CBS's commentary, why don't we do the Pepsi Challenge? I took the exact same segment of the race commentary from three different broadcasts of this 2007 Grand Prix de Catalunya. And I used the official Dorna MotoGP.com audio that we get with Nick Harris, Matthew Roberts, and Gavin Emmett doing the work in the studio, and Mark Brax down there in the pit lane. And then I've got the Eurosport commentary with Toby Moody, Julian Ryder, and Randy Mamola. And last, we're going to hear the over-the-air CBS broadcast with Jeff Metters and Kevin Schwantz. Each of these pieces is about a minute long. Like I said, I took the exact section of each one, so bear with me here. A little bit of patience. Now, the part of the race that we're working with is the beginning of lap 18. So if you want to find the same chunk of video that I'm working with, look for it at the right at the beginning of lap 18 when they're showing the standings for lap 17 right there on the screen, right as Barros is trying to get past Hayden at the end of the front straight. We're going to start out there, Barros trying to pass Hayden. Then we jump to an overhead shot of Rossi making a move on Stoner at the Repsol corner, and he makes the pass stick after a couple of corners, and this action continues through the infield section and down the back straight, and the segment ends right before the riders get to the Europe car corner. So, first off, why don't we listen to Matthew Roberts and Nick Harris? Matthew is talking about Barros trying to pass Hayden. Then about 8 seconds into it, the shot changes, and he starts getting really super excited. And then wait for Nick Harris to come in, and he sounds like he's about to have a coronary.
Everything about outbreaking manoeuvres is Alex Barros, and he's having a go at Nicky Hayden now. But Nicky Hayden he's done so well to hold off Alex Barros there. And Nicky Hayden holds on. Here comes Valentino Rossi. Valentino Rossi goes through on Stoner, but Stoner goes back past him. And you see, he's trying a different corner now, Valentino Rossi. He's trying the right-hander before this left, and this time the left-hander, and he goes through. And Valentino Rossi hangs on this time, does he? Stoner's there once more. Rossi and Stoner side by side.
Wow, has Rossi it stuck? It has stuck this time. Rossi leads properly for the first time. Stoner couldn't be closer. They're going to go onto that right hander that brings them onto the back straight. Stoner wants to fight back immediately. They come onto the back straight. We ride with Valentino Rossi. This is Casey Stoner. He would try and get up the inside now on the brakes. He's not close enough. Now, can Casey Stoner stay with Valentino Rossi? 7.5 laps ago. This is the fiercest battle we've seen this season. And certainly Stoner is right on the rear wheel as they come into the stadium and the right-handers. What a race. What a performance by these three.
I think Valentino Rossi...
Now that is passion for the sport. I mean, you can just hear these guys, how much they love it. You know, it might be a little bit too much for some people, and I'll admit that I've done my fair share, probably more than my fair share, of Nick Harris bashing in the past, but you have to admit that the guy really loves the sports, and so does the rest of the commentary team. They're knowledgeable, they're enthusiastic, they transmit that enthusiasm to their audience. Okay, next up, exact same part of the race again, with the Eurosport team. So here we start off with a guest bit that is MotoGP journalist and famous author, Neil Spaulding. He's doing a little bit of color commentary about what Honda has done to Pedrosa's bike to help him manage the bike during the latter part of a race. And Toby Moody has to sort of butt in when Rossi makes his move at that Repsol corner. And Toby gets progressively more and more excited. And when he finally stops to breathe, we hear Julian Ryder and Randy Mamola kind of cut in.
Slower in the second half of the race than the first half because he can't control the slides. Maybe what he's got now is allowing him to just to hold it online a little bit better in the later half of the race.
Sorry, Neil. Rossi leads for a moment. Casey Stoner cuts him back, and he's having a go along that long right-hand hairpin, but Rossi's got the inside line, and Stoner's got no answer for that because Rossi does a block pass. Can the Ducati leap out of the corner? He's going to have a go. Fair dinkum to the Aussie. He's not going to give up, but there's just not quite long enough of a straight to get through.
Valentino Rossi plans these things, but Stoner is right on him.
Yeah, this is the acceleration of the Ducati. Listen, it'll be no contest. when he clicks his bike into another gear on the front straight, unless Rossi can open a gap in this stadium section. Look at the Ducati.
He's going to have a go.
He won't do it here. Why, but the Stoner's tire on the left-hand side here, he should be able to stay with Rossi easy in this section of the race. Now, look, he's actually trying to go up underneath him. Rossi's bike getting a little bit sideways. But you wait until you see the speed of that Ducati when it's behind something. It's fast enough when it's in towing thing.
Okay, again, these guys are getting excited. You can sense their excitement. You can tell that they really love the sport. They're actually watching this race with the same edge of the seat sort of excitement like you and I will. Julian Ryder is probably one of the most knowledgeable guys in the paddock. He's just fantastic. And Mamola is doing a really good job of color commentary. He's telling us about the Ducati's power advantage in this sort of particular bit. But Mamola is always he's always fun to hear. And, you know, this commentary is sort of very professional. It's to me, it's more like Speed's Formula One coverage where they use Bob Varsha, Steve Matchett, and David Hobbs, which is, I've always kind of thought, the gold standard of race commentary for me. I really enjoy the Formula One coverage on Speed. That's the only reason I watch Formula One. You've got technical, knowledgeable, enthusiastic, and funny coverage, no Southern accents. They know what they're doing, and I think they do a really good job. And I just wish that Speed would find a team that could do that for MotoGP, which they could. They have the talent on board. It wouldn't be all that different. But that's a whole different story that we're not talking about right now. So last, let's go to Jeff Metters and Kevin Schwantz doing the CBS coverage that we endured on Saturday or on Sunday. Excuse me. Again, this is the exact same part of the race. We're going to start where Barros tries to pass at the end of the front straight. But Kevin Schwantz is talking about Rossi being strong on the brakes as they go into turn one. Then about 8 seconds into this, the camera view switches to the overhead of Rossi moving in on Stoner, which is when the really exciting stuff is happening. And not that Barros making a move on Hayden isn't all that exciting, but, you know, he didn't actually make it stick. And they're kind of a way back from the leaders, so the stuff up front is what we should be, you know, yelling about and getting all excited. Now I'm going to put in a now when we get to the right point there on the corner, because otherwise you might miss it.
Went off into turn one.
And there's Nicky Hayden.
Nicky Hayden being challenged now by Alex Barros there into the first turn.
We talked about the frustration that Nicky Hayden has had so far this season.
Rossi made another pass but wasn't able to hold on to that position, and now he's going to make
right
that pass again. Looks like he's going to be able to hang on to it here.
Valentino Rossi starting on the pole, and Stoner not making it easy for him, but, you know, played with them a little bit, a little game of cat and mouse, and these guys right back at it. You can tell that Stoner wants that lead back.
Casey Stoner riding really, really well today. Anytime Valentino makes a move and comes by, he's just wanting to get right back into the lead, try and get Valentino back into second position.
Well, we saw Valentino stalk him for a while, made a couple of moves, and finally pulls it off successfully, and you can see Stoner trying to get back to the inside there. Can't quite get there. How aggressive do you think Stoner's going to be in getting that lead back?
Man, he's really did a good job.
Sorry about that. I think I dozed off there during that. I hope you didn't. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a huge Kevin Schwantz fan. I think he's a real live MotoGP legend, and I think he's perfectly capable of doing the great job as a commentator, like I said earlier in this intro. But this CBS coverage wasn't exactly his shining moment. And it might be because he's got Jeff Metters with him, who sounds like he'd rather be covering a fishing tournament, or maybe it's because he knows that CBS is only just barely going to be on board with this whole MotoGP silliness, or, you know, and would much rather be broadcasting golf, right? Whatever the reason is, Schwantz just could not save this commentary from itself. It didn't work. So now one thing I'm going to give CBS credit for is that this MotoGP coverage is a little bit better than the commentary for the Formula One races that CBS broadcast in 2005 and 2006, which is just absolutely dismal. They did not dumb things down nearly as much for the MotoGP as they did for Formula One. But if I recall correctly, and I might just be blocking out the painful memories, I'm not sure, those F1 races had at least a little bit of excitement in the commentary. I mean, the guy sort of, you know, raised his voice. But the dumbing down was so bad. Derek Daly, it was just, it was terrible. And that's the biggest problem with CBS's MotoGP broadcast, was that it was a snooze fest. I mean, I'd rather that they were up there making mistakes and saying, you know, hey, there's Hayden, when it's actually Pedrosa or vice versa or whatever, because these guys just didn't sound very thrilled. They didn't sound like they're excited to be there. And, you know, to be fair, like I said, Metters has done his homework and Schwantz, you know, doesn't need to. So the guys mostly know what they're talking about. But like I said, I'd rather they were making mistakes and sounding exciting. But aside from the crap comments like, you know, the NASCAR of motorcycle racing and the most dangerous sport in the world and all that, that they kind of felt compelled to throw in there, most of the color commentary type stuff, the non-play-by-play, it wasn't too bad. You know, they talked about tires and heat affecting the riders and G-forces and all sort of semi-technical stuff without getting too technical. Because, I mean, they're just not going to drown us with lots of technical jargon and obscure little facts that only a mega fan is going to know about. But, you know, they have to keep this suitable for the average guy who isn't really a MotoGP fan. And I understand that. But don't you think that the average non-MotoGP fan is not – he's going to be helped more by a little bit of excitement, you know, some kind of audio cue that something really freaking cool is going to be coming up on the screen or is coming up on the screen right now. So come on, CBS. You guys have two more races to cover this year, and you need to redeem yourselves. So let's see a big improvement at Assen. All right. Hi, Liam. How are you doing? You got some time to talk to us today?
Hey, Bob. How's it going? Of course. I always have time for MotoGPOD.
Outstanding. Tell us a little bit about, we didn't get a chance to talk much after Mugello because, you know, you were in a big busy crunch there between the two races. I was busy. So we've got two races to talk about here, Mugello and Catalunya. So just kind of, what's going on? What's the feeling in the team? How's the atmosphere? Were you happy with those results there in Catalunya?
You know, it was such a great result for Barros in Mugello that I think all of us, the motivation was so high. We know that when we've got all the right pieces lined up, everything's working right, when everything's clicking, we run with the best of them. And great race for Barros, considering that I didn't feel the tire choice was maybe the best one for the race, because we all anticipated that it was going to get colder. I just on a fun, you know, our weather station, which we use to predict weather and work with our bike systems, got stolen by the giant mob of people.
Right,
after the race
that
in
last
Mugello.
Week.
Yeah. Still thinking about it because I have to source a new one.
So what did you guys, you had to use the internet or?
Yeah, we had to use the internet, which is not quite as accurate as on-site. And it's not wired into our systems, you know, we have to manually input a lot of stuff. But anyway, Mugello was great. And then quickly flying back on the bounce, we had a free day basically before Catalunya, which is when I caught up with you the last time. And after that, it was seemed like the Catalunya race was full tilt boogie. A lot more pressure, I think, that the mechanics and the team was feeling, because we know that we're capable of those results now. So no one is trying to let anything slip. Everybody is focusing doubly hard on the bikes, and it seemed like there was an added stress, you know, from the Barros side of the garage. They were like, okay, we know we've got a podium guy. We know we can win races. We're leaving no stone unturned. So they went through things with a fine-tooth comb, and we did our absolute best. But we struggled with the setup all weekend. We just couldn't get the right feeling with both riders, Hoffman and Barros. And it wasn't until Saturday in the qualifying session that we found what we thought was a solution for both riders. Ironically enough, a pretty similar chassis setup to what Stoner was running. And I think that as much as beating the factory was maybe not the best thing for the factory in Italy the week before, the fact that they were open and trying to help us in Catalunya was a really, really nice gesture. So much love to the Ducati factory for giving us advice and trying to see us through a difficult weekend, which turned out the race pace was pretty good. The tires that we ran in the race, I was very, very happy. And just watching Barros creep up on the Landry lap after lap, the final five laps, watching the times drop, and then seeing him make the pass in the last section of the last lap was magnificent. You didn't see it on the feed, but we saw it immediately when it happened on our monitors, thanks to the timing equipment that we got. So when that happened, it was like, oh, thank God, we got an extra position right at the end of the race.
Yeah, that would have been great to see, because I was kind of wondering.
So. Yeah, it was right in the last section, I think, of right-handers that we managed to get it. And so that was great. Hoffman really didn't really have a great race with Hoffman as much as we would have wanted to, and capitalizing on the good feeling we had coming out of Le Mans. Mugello and Catalunya for Hoffman, I don't think those were great races because I now expect so much more out of him, and I think everyone else does. And, you know, if he can internalize all of that and know that he can do it, that he can be a top 10 guy, you know, then we'll start to see a little bit more consistency out of him. One thing is clear, though, after Le Mans, Dunlop has taken a step forward with their tires. They have a new range of material. And speaking with the Dunlop guys, they are really happy about the progress that they've made. There's been some investment of money and capital, and they're starting to take bigger steps forward. It's particularly evident, it seems like, when we switched the 800s, the grid time that separated first and last on a qualifying was before 4.5 seconds, but that's been halved. We've seen it in enough races so far where the top 10 or top 12, whatever, are covered by 1 second. So the 800s, with the increased electronics and understanding of how the bikes work and what it takes to make them go around corners quickly, the electronics have really brought the bikes closer together. And even Dunlop has taken great steps forward. Where it used to be 4.5 seconds, they're now 2 seconds off. And in the race, in the last few races, we've seen them making some really good times, consistent times. So as much as I was a little bummed to see Hoffman getting stuck down there in the Catalunya race, on the other hand, I was, you know, a little bit pumped for Dunlop because they're working really hard, and they've had a bunch of rough seasons. We had a rough season with them last year and the year before. So mixed feelings for me on the Catalunya result for Hoffman and a solid ride for Barros. It moved him up into eighth position in the world standing. And, you know, when I look at the times and who's running fast and consistent, Hopkins is definitely looking like a shoo-in for fourth place unless he makes an even bigger step forward throughout the remainder of the season. He's just been so consistent and strong. And, you know, you mentioned that night after the race that he got out of the slipstream once. And once he was out of the slipstream with Rossi, Pedrosa, and Stoner, he just couldn't claw back. He couldn't get back into it. So he lost touch with the lead group. But it would have been magnificent if he'd been able to hang on to see four riders there, nose to tail, just so close. That was a wild race. I think that goes down as one of the best races in the four-stroke history. Because it wasn't just two riders going tooth and nail. There were three guys there. And that had to give some kind of extra added pressure on Rossi to not make the Hail Mary stuff that he was doing in Shanghai. And also Stoner was aware that, because you can hear these bikes, it's not like, oh, there's one rider behind me. There was obviously two riders, and they were so hungry. Everybody was so hungry at that race. Magnificent race.
Yeah, it was a good one. I mean, none of that kind of, well, we've been seeing a little bit this year where the sort of the latter part of the race is a bit of a strung out freight train or anything. I mean, the lap chart for the last few laps with Stoner and Rossi passing, was just amazing. And everybody, you know, we didn't get a chance to see all of it on the feed because, you know, they were concentrating on the front three, but it was a fantastic race. So you were saying that you got a lot of help from Ducati and everything. Do you think that you sort of had a bit of a, almost a, I don't know what new term might say, you know, some sort of breakthrough or something where you're getting even more help from them than you have been? Or was it just something, what was so particularly helpful about them at Catalunya?
Well, I think what we were struggling with was the heat of the track and the feeling we were getting off those tires. So we experimented with various chassis setups and suspension settings and you know, going in different directions. And neither rider really felt that they had something comfortable that would go the race distance, that they knew that they could work hard. And Stoner didn't have a great Friday either, and neither did Caparossi. But on Saturday morning, Stoner made a step forward and was like, hey, I found something that I think works. Maybe you guys want to try it out. You know, and it's not that simple. I can't say Stoner walked over and said, hey, guys, check it out. But, you know, obviously the engineers and the technicians got together and said, hey, this is looking good. The data looks good. The bike's working good. It's fast. Let's see how other people like it, you know, and they suggested a direction we could go with our bikes. And the riders immediately had a better feeling. They thought, oh, wow, okay, this is good. And it shows that, you know, the family is strong, even though the big brother, little brother team or satellite, whatever you want to call it. You know, a lot of times some of the Ducati Corsa personnel have come in and spoken with Barros and Barros's chief, and they've always valued Hoffman's feedback about tires and chassis. So they've taken information from us. We've asked them for information, and it was just really good to see that you know, there wasn't any kind of, oh, we're not sharing anything, big secrets, blah, blah, blah. It was good. They said, hey, you know, we're not telling you to do this, but we think it could be better if you want to try it. So we tried it, and it was good. It just showed that the family was a little bit stronger than I necessarily might have thought after Mugello.
Well, that's cool. That's really that's a good thing to hear. I got a question for you that a listener sent in about tires, if you can answer it. I'm not 100% sure. It's not super secret.
Okay.
But he says, this is a guy I know from the boards. He's Hornet One. It's Kevin Crawford. And he says, my question is about the 16-inch Michelins. I think they may be the biggest drawbacks for some riders suffering this season, and as much as the change to 800cc. I saw on the official website where they said that the circumference of the tire is about the same as the 16.5, but the new tire has a better contact patch. I'm sure this is true, but I find it crazy that they would make the move to a new tire size while producing an all-new bike and not have the 16.5 tires available anymore. So do you know if this is also true with the Bridgestone teams? I think Bridgestone tested a 16-inch rear, but decided to hold off until later in the year to race with it. So are the 16.5s available to your riders? So is that stuff that you can talk about?
A little bit. I've mentioned this before, I think, in an earlier podcast this year, that maybe one of Michelin's problems was that they went to a 16-inch tire with a new bike.
Right,
I
do remember that.
It was a ballsy move. I did mention it before. Bridgestone has experimented. They do have a front qualifier that we are not using. No one is using it at this point. It's been used in testing only, but it's such a... It's hard to improve upon the front tire that Bridgestone has at this point. And they're aiming for consistency and rider feel across the board because they service almost every manufacturer except Yamaha at this point. So Bridgestone's not going to bring out the front qualifier until it's ready. We'll probably test it again after Brno. As far as a 16-inch rear tire, I've heard of it existing. I'm sure we'll see something like that in the future. It's kind of strange how everything is so tied together with the bikes. Nothing really takes a quantum leap forward until it, or if it does, it brings up everything else around it until the entire package is balanced. And then when you take another small step forward in a different direction, the whole package has to shift in that direction. And we see it with controllability, tractability of power. We see it in tire life. We see Rossi just amazing under the brakes. One thing's for sure, these front tires really deform under braking to a level that no one outside of MotoGP really realizes, I think. You know, while the 16-inch tire that Michelin is using definitely has a larger contact patch when it's on the sidewall, it definitely has a bigger contact patch when you jam on the brakes from 200 miles an hour. And it's kind of fascinating when you think about the tire pressures people are running and how much abuse the front tires take. Because it's one thing to accelerate a bike out of a long corner and down a straightaway while the tire's spinning and just, you know, scratching and grabbing at the asphalt, trying to get everything spinning, and it's wild to accelerate a bike like that. And then you've got a smaller tire in front, and all of a sudden you are going to jam on the brake, throw the bike over while you ease off the brake, and keep on the brakes all the way into the apex. The load on that front tire is incredible. To me, the real secret is the front. It's fascinating stuff. I wish I could get into it more. I wish I knew more about it, to be honest with you, but you know, everyone's pretty secretive about things, especially when it comes to the tires.
How do they, when you say that, you know, that the front tires deform a lot under braking and everything, is this something that Is there telemetry that measures that?
No. No, I don't believe that there is. I do know of one team using an in-wheel temperature sensor. It's inside the rim, and it monitors how hot it gets inside the tire, meaning that the compound and the gases used inside the tire, you know, they'll heat up as the tire carcass heats up, and it measures that. I don't know if it measures pressure either, pressure changes, but I'm aware that there's something like that out there. We obviously don't use something like that, but yeah, there's all kinds of neat stuff. I mean, the bottom line in racing is, you know, how fast do you want to go? How much do you want to spend? What kind of engineering solutions do you want to come up with? How much money do you want to spend? And really, you know, as much as I love it for being completely prototyped, you know, at some point, wow, that's a lot of money.
That is true. Yes, it's an insane amount of money. But I've said this one before, that so much of it filters down to us on the street eventually. And it's, mm-hmm. you know,
I just saw a neat photograph, or an artist rendering of a future CBR that had a really, really minuscule tail section, much like RC212s that Honda's running this year in GP. I thought, wow, what a radical, aggressive design. Not sure if it's good for passengers, but neat. Yeah, it's neat to see how things filter down. I mean, the obvious thing was the ride-by-wire that we saw on the Yamaha R6 a few years back. And, you know, obviously more things are coming with what we're learning about how to utilize fuel and how to create power and do it, you know, over a distance, not that kind of power right at the very top, but usable power. I mean, these are things that are only going to benefit every street rider in the future.
Yeah.
I can't wait, actually. I feel so strange that, you know, the real bikes of my heart are twin pistons, bigger than my fist, hammering along, just gigantic mounds of aluminum, you know, instant torque, monstrous power, and it's going to go the way of the dinosaur. You know, we're going to start seeing less and less of these beasts running around. So if you get a chance to buy one, just buy one.
Yeah.
The next thing you know, we're going to be running around on 200cc sport bikes with the power of a current 600. I don't know. Electric bike.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely flat torque curve. But, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not too
electric
sure.
Motors. Instant torque immediately.
All the way across
no
the
lag. Way. Yeah. Touch in. Sound like crap.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd have to have some kind of I'm sure that somebody would take care of making it sound better somehow, you know. So.
Yeah, like a card in the spokes or something.
I was thinking like a, you know, an MP3 player hooked up to a megaphone with a card in the spokes is a better idea. So
yeah.
We don't want to talk about
a bunch
of green
bike. As you start going faster, the whistle, like an old siren, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, about the races, just trying to come back to the races. It's been a really heavy 2 weeks for everybody involved. I think part of that was due to the good result in Mugello. It gave us so much added pressure for Catalunya. And then to top it off, there was a 1 or 2 day test for the teams after the race. So you've got 2 weeks of racing and scorching hot weather again. And we're testing on Monday, and the factory teams were testing on Monday and Tuesday. It was like, holy smokes, guys. We need a break before the next two races come up with Donington and Assen. It was really, really put everyone under a lot of strain, I think. Even though generally testing is a little bit more relaxed, the riders still have to be on the ball. They can't make any mistakes. They can't drop a bike because, you know, it's serious every time.
Right. I'm sure the mechanics still have to be on the ball too. You're still, you know, you're out there, you're working. It's a.
Yeah, absolutely. What makes it a little easier is that you don't have a time frame. It's not like, okay, get out right now, and then, you know, the bike comes back in, and we got to do all these changes before the next session. You know, basically, the bike goes out, and we make so many more laps on a testing day than we would during a Friday or a Saturday. And when the bike comes in, you want to make changes. Okay, we make changes. Rider sits down, has something to drink or eat, and then we can go back out again. So there's no pressure of knowing, oh, we got to have the bike ready before this time. it's ready when it's ready. But because this is MotoGP and the mechanics are all at a certain level and the teams all operate at a certain level, it's so expensive to be out there. Every minute is precious that we don't screw around. And, you know, when they say, okay, change the bike over, boom, it's changed over just as fast in a testing day, it seems, as it is in a race day.
Sure, I'll bet. But, yeah, I'm sure that it's a somewhat different atmosphere. Notice that you guys only tested on the Monday and not the Tuesday. Was that what was the reason for that?
I'm not sure. I don't know if it was financial-based or maybe Bridgestone didn't have enough material to test with all the teams. I honestly don't know. I was just looking forward to the end of Monday because I wanted to get back to my own bed in Barcelona after staying at the racetrack, the Hotel Ibis behind the racetrack during the Catalunya race. It just made more sense to stay at the racetrack because it's easier to get to the circuit in the morning for me and easier to stay focused rather than coming home and perhaps getting distracted by, you know, friends that I have in the area. It's good to be with the team when you're at the races, I think.
Sure. Speaking of friends, how are you, Liam, you know, what doing in Spain? Are you hanging out with a lot of people that are not working in MotoGP or like all your friends involved with MotoGP or, you know, how's things going with you?
Pretty much. I lead a solitary life out here. I catch up with my roommate when I see her every couple of weeks. And then I see Hero every couple of weeks. And there's a reporter, a Catalan reporter, that I'll see every couple of weeks. And pretty much, you know, I go for my bicycle ride and then I go to the coffee shop and do my work on the computer or I do it at my house. I think I'm better friends with a bartender down the street from me than anybody. So it's, you know, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of time to maintain a friendship or relationships because I'm always on the move. Kevin Cameron told me last year that the life of a MotoGP mechanic, you know, an international race mechanic, superbike, doesn't matter. The first thing you got to learn how to deal with is loneliness. So thank God for the computer. I got totally backed up with emails over the last couple of weeks after Miguel because I didn't have the internet or telephone signal out what we were saying. And then Catalunya was just such a big push that I wasn't able to reply to a lot of people. I've been trying to catch up this week and also continue working with the factory and make sure that they are going to have material ready for us for the next two races and beyond. Particularly worried about Laguna Seca because it's impossible to ship things overnight or 2 day if we get into real trouble when we're at Laguna Seca. So the next two races, I'll be going through all our material again, especially electronics and whatnot, and making sure that, oh, okay, we need this stuff for Saxon Ring. We need it before we go to Laguna Seca, and it's got to be clear like that. As much as we get along great with the guys from the Marlboro team, you know, both teams will come over and congratulate one another on great results. And we were in their box minutes, you know, seconds after Stoner sold it off in Catalunya. As much as we get along with the Marlboro team is not completely the Ducati team. I mean, Ducati factory is something else. It's a whole different beast with different attitudes. While Marlboro helped us a lot in Catalunya, it's important to make sure that the Ducati factory keeps helping us after Mugello. We have to strengthen our relationship, I think. You know, always looking towards the future, looking towards good results, because what's good for the brand and what's good, I think it's especially good that we had a good result in Mugello, because we showed everyone else that the satellite team can run with the factory. That's great for attracting other riders potentially for next year. Maybe if there's an up-and-coming rider that says, oh, I don't want to ride for this team, but then you can say, hey, the bike can make the podium, the bike can challenge. It's just up to the rider. You know, so that makes the factory look good. And it makes our team look good because we know we can do it. I've always maintained that we can do it. I always had faith, but someone called me up on Monday, my Australian family, called me up, some friends that I made at Phillip Island. They said, hey, it must feel really good to get that monkey off your back. And this was the day after Mugello. And I was like, you know, I hadn't even thought of that. But, yeah, it was a neat vindication or justification. Like, ah, that's what it's like. That's what we're working for. Makes sense again. Not just to watch a great race on the monitors, but to be involved with a great race. So that felt really good. But then it kind of sat in the back of my head. And then I guess this is what I attribute the pressure we felt in Mamalo. Everyone was like, okay, now that we've proved we can do it, we've got to do it again. And everything's got to be there. For my style, it didn't really go too well. But I like everything to be a little bit calm, steady, even Steven, balanced, tranquil. Like, okay, we know we got a job to do. We're going to do the job. We're going to do it nice and easy. Take it easy. And we're going to go out there and kick ass. I really don't like it when it gets really fervored, you know, and crazy. I'm like, whoa! You know, and in my experience, that's when it's easy to overlook something. You know, everyone out here multitasks to such a huge degree. And to stay on top of everything, I think everyone needs to kind of just settle down a little bit. And we were so excited after Mugello that I was worried that we might have problems in Catalunya. We did have some bike trouble in qualifying with Alex Hoffman. The next thing I knew, five of us were working on the B bike, the second bike, to turn it to the A bike specs. Maybe six of us were actually working on it at one time. Everybody had their hands on the bike, and we flipped the bike in record time. So I was really, really proud of everybody. And Hoffman went out with very limited track time during the qualifying session, and within a couple laps, I mean, in the very last second on his last qualifier, he pulled a 10th off for the grid. So he was pretty stoked on that. And I think for the team, that was really good because we all got together, the mechanics, me, and everybody, and was like, we all shook hands, like, hey, that was a rough qualifying session, but we all stuck in there together and we got it done. And I was really proud of the crew for that. I think more than the race. I mean, we always worked for the race, but that was, for me, that was a good team building. It's important to recognize those rather than just roll them over and, oh, that's to be expected. Everything should be like that. Because you know, as much as it is about racing, it's a team. Mickey Hayden had said, you know, you don't win by yourself. You win as a team. You lose as a team. And it was just really good to see everybody just jump in there and say, okay, what can I do? All right, I know exactly what I have to do. And everybody went and did something different, and we all got it taken care of.
That's a cool thing. And like you were saying with the podiums, you know, it's one thing to sort of know that you can do it and have this, you know, this knowledge, this internal knowledge that you'll be up there, but it's another thing to actually see it happen. And we were all really happy for you. I mean, Jules and I were watching the race, not together in the same room, but together on the internet, and we're yay, you know. So
yeah, it was pretty wild. It was pretty wild. I mean, blood was in the water, and Barros just went for it. That's all I can say on that. I mean, when you're on the move, well, it doesn't matter who's in front of you. You can beat them. That's what you do. Burgess told me, I took the flight back from Bologna to Barcelona with Jeremy Burgess and the Yamaha crew of Valentino Rossi. So we had a chance to kind of catch up between our two teams. They were like, congratulations on the performance and on the podium. We were like, congratulations on your sixth straight win. And, you know, it was pretty happy. And, When that came up about Barros passing Stoner and you know, gifting three more points to Rossi, Jeremy Burgess got this neat look in his eye, smiled at me, and he said, you know, Barros is a real racer. He's always been a racer. And I knew exactly what he meant. You know, it was just a feeling. Like, you know, certain people, certain riders ride on talent, certain riders always push, and they become very skilled. You know, along with enormous talent, anybody at this level has the talent. And then there are racers, and it's something that you can't quantify it. You can't. It's something that Alberto Puig can see. It's something that somebody saw in Kevin Schwantz. Somebody saw it in John Hopkins. There are qualities that make a racer, and it was really cool that Jeremy said that. So that was a good flight. That was a great flight, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing, you know, no matter where your path, you, Liam, where your path takes you through life, these last couple of years must be just so, you know, special, full of great experiences.
Yeah, they're filled with moments. I'll never forget. I noticed it last year, 2006, before the midseason, how much older Rossi looked. I thought, wow, the kid's only 26, 27, but once you live this life and the travel and everything else involved, and with all the media pressure he's got and everything he goes through, you know, it's obvious he matures faster than all of us. Maybe his heart rate's lower, but everyone's getting a little bit older. And he looked exhausted after Mugello, just absolutely drained, wiped out. I saw when his helmet was on, then he took his helmet off, and I was just like, wow, he put everything out there, like every ounce. And his spirit was just in that race, and that's why he won.
Right.
So it was pretty clear.
I think he's been doing that at quite a lot of races this year, this season, where he's just... he's really, really pushing himself a lot, and he's having to ride. And that might say a lot for Ducati. It might say a lot for Casey Stoner, you know, whatever the reasons are. You know, maybe we're seeing Stoner is going to be the next great thing. I don't know. Or maybe he's just having the one fantastic season. You know, we'll find out in time. But whatever it is, he's giving Rossi a run for his money, and I think Rossi is really, really feeling the pressure and having to work for it.
Well, I don't know about that, about feeling pressure. I think for Rossi, this is exactly what he wanted when he left Honda. When he went to Yamaha, he knew it was going to be a big challenge. He wants the challenge. He loves the fight more than anything. His greatest races have been against Capo Rossi. He's had great races with Biaggi and Gibernau, but he's never expressed the joy, even in defeat, that he's expressed with Stoner or Capo Rossi or Hayden. I posted this on the forum. I said, hey, you know, who do you think he would pick if he had to choose to lose? You know, it's obvious that he loves the race and the challenge and the fight, and he puts himself out there all the way just for that. It's magnificent to see him riding at this level, because, you know, he's on another level, and sometimes Stoner can get up to that level, and sometimes Pedrosa's up on that level. But Rossi consistently is able to access something else that other people don't have. And to see him battle with Ducati, it could be any bike. It could be any other rider. But he is genuinely happy when he's racing at the limit with Stoner. I mean, he knows that he's got to put 100% out there. Nothing more, because that's all there is. And as much as he's thinking about the world championship and he wants it back, I think he's genuinely happy to be racing again. And anybody that says that he's lost any of the fire or the passion or whatever, they better take a hard look in the mirror. I mean, this is Valentino Rossi we're talking about.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely not saying he's lost any of the passion. That's for sure. He's definitely up
when there. I saw it up close in Mugello, and then again in Catalunya, with how he expressed himself after the race and other races this year, it's obvious. This is what he was looking for. This is what he wanted. And the brand of the bike doesn't matter. I mean, if the Honda was this dominant with their 800 and he was riding against a great Honda rider, if he was having to go at this level, I'm sure he would enjoy it just the same.
All right, Liam, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to kind of cut the call short here a little bit, because my boring, comparatively boring to yours, real life is intruding, and I'm going to have to go. But thank you so much for your time. I'm glad we managed to catch you. It's the middle of the afternoon for you, and it's always great talking to you.
No problem, Bob. It's always great to catch up and kind of keep people in the loop through MotoGPOD. I think it's been a real gift to a lot of people and to myself to kind of recount these stories and relive it in my head. And I know a lot of people get a charge out of it. I get some fantastic emails from the listeners. And just want to say, you know, everybody just keep on watching the races, because, man, if we thought 06 was a great year, 07 is an even better year. And then from what I know about 2008, with the rumors that are swirling around, 2008 is going to be a crazy year.
I don't know if my heart can take it watching these races, but whatever. We got to go, Liam.
We'll get together and do a silly season thing in the summertime.
Oh, yeah. That'll be good times.
All right. Take care, Bob, and take care, everybody.
That's going to do it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you very much for downloading it. As always, like I said earlier on, the email address is bob@motogpod.com. I'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to send email to myself and Jules Cisek and Jim Race, all hosts of the show at one time or another, the email address for that is motogpod@motogpod.com. And again, we'd always love to hear from you. Like I said in the intro, we are talking about some Laguna Seca meetings and everything. So if you have any ideas for that, you know, give me an email, or better yet, throw it out for discussion on the RideOn2.com forum. And make sure you check out all of Moto Liam's website at MotoLiam.com. That's Liam Schubert's blog, where he's talking about Liam's, you know, his great adventures that he's having being the mechanic for Premec Dantin. Liam's Wild Ride is what he's calling it. And he's got great pictures that he posts up there. And we always like having Liam on the show. He's a really interesting guy, super nice, just all around a great asset to the show and good fun to have on here. And I think that's going to about cover it. If I missed anything, and the fault is entirely mine. And I, again, thanks a lot for downloading the show. Don't forget that next week is Donington. And for those of you in the United States that are watching the show on television, it's going to be back on Speed. It'll be on Sunday afternoon. I didn't check the time, but it's usually around 2 o'clock. And we will have a Donington pre-race show next week. So we'll listen to that. Those of you that are international listeners, well, it's going to be wherever it normally is, Eurosport or Star, or wherever you watch MotoGP. And for those of you that are subscribing to the official MotoGP.com live races kind of deal, it's going to be on MotoGP.com. They run the Donington race at a different time to keep it at the same time. So as far as I know, it should still be at 5 a.m. Pacific or 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time in the United States. You're about the same time. Please check the official MotoGP.com website to make sure of the time. Don't trust me because I'm just throwing stuff off the top of my head. I'm going to check the time, so you probably better too. And I will try to mention it again in the next week's Donington Race Show. After that, it's going to CBS again for Assen and Sachsenring. Don't forget, Assen is actually being run on the Saturday. Now, this is a long time in the future, so you don't have to worry too much about it. Make sure you check your television schedules. Don't forget to watch the races one place or the other, whether it's on MotoGP.com, whether it's on Speed or CBS or Eurosport or whatever you have. Make sure you watch the races, and we'll see you guys next week for our Donington pre-race show. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL, and despite the fact that Bob has the audio charisma of a talking fish, the MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGP OD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners.